Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 530. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Well, coming up on this episode of the podcast, it's going to be a prospect-heavy podcast. We're going to talk about some of the latest prospect rankings that have come out, both Baseball America and Baseball Prospectus out with their top 100 and top 101 lists, respectively. And we're going to talk about the Phillies who are on that list. Plus, we're going to take a deeper dive into some Phillies prospects with Jeff Paternostro, who is the lead prospect writer for Baseball Prospectus. We'll talk about the Phillies that he had and they had in their top 101, as well as a couple of other guys. And so that is going to be our focus here today on this episode of Hittin' Season. Before we get started, just a reminder to check out all of our Good Fight podcasts. There's a brand new Continued Success out right now with Justin Clue and Liz Rocher. That went up on Thursday night. A really good episode if you haven't checked it out, episode 164, talking about the Nationals booth. Kevin Franzen is going to be leaving the Phillies radio broadcast and moving over to the Washington Nationals TV booth. So a raise, I guess, and a promotion for Kevin Franzen. Going to be sad to see him go. Probably the, outside of Scott Fransky, the best broadcaster that we had on either of the Phillies broadcasts. And they also talked about a labor column from Ken Rosenthal and Mark Leiter Jr. And I know you are hungry for the Mark Leiter Jr. content. So it's really great stuff. It's entertaining. So make sure you check out the latest edition of Continued Success. It is on your podcast format right now. All right, let's jump into these prospect lists. And before we get to the Baseball Prospectus Top 101, let's go over the Baseball America Top 100 list. And we have only two Phillies on their list. Mick Abel, who comes in at number 51, and then shortstop Bryson Stott, who comes in at number 67. Now, on the Baseball Scout rating system of 20 to 80, 80 being the most high-end you can get and 20 being the low-end, they give his fastball a 65. He's got a 50 curveball, 60 slider, 60 changeup, 55 control. Of course, we haven't seen much of Mick Abel. He made his professional debut with Low A Clearwater last year after being drafted in the first round of the Major League Baseball draft back in 2020. He looked pretty good, but of course, shoulder tendonitis ended his season in mid-July. But he does regularly throw in the mid-90s. There have been some reports this offseason that he has reached triple digits, so that is certainly eye-opening. He's also got a slider that regularly registers in the low to mid 80s. According to Baseball America, those are his two best pitches right now. But again, that shoulder tendonitis, I know that everybody says it's not worrisome, but as Phillies fans, we know that pitching prospects in this organization seem to be snake bit by physical injuries. It limited Sixto Sanchez. It's one of the reasons why the Phillies were willing to trade him in the JT Realmuto deal. And let's be honest, he has not been able to stay healthy in the Marlins system. It looked like going into last year that Sixto Sanchez was ready to take the leap, but it never happened because he was hurt and missed virtually the entire season. So I don't think it's great that he missed half the season last year with shoulder tendonitis. We'll see if he bounces back. But with Sixto Sanchez, we saw it as an issue, and we saw it as an issue with Spencer Howard. The reason Spencer Howard was used so clunkily last year is because at the end of the 2019 season, he got hurt and had to be shut down. So they were going to ease him into things in 2020. But then you had the pandemic hit. And so he was never able to build up his innings. I mean, in 2020, the idea was, I think, that he would start the season in the rotation or at least fight for a rotation spot. And maybe you give him like 120 to 130 innings to kind of build his arm back up. And he wasn't able to get that. He only, I forget what it was, but he only got like 40 or 50 innings that year. And so then you go into 2021 with a pitcher who can't, you don't want to use him as a reliever. You need him as a starting pitcher, but you also want him at the big league level contributing because he's absolutely, at the time, one of your five best starting pitchers. And having him in AAA doesn't do you a whole lot of good there either. You needed him at the big league level, but he was bad at the big league level. He just could never go past two innings. Every time he went through a lineup a second time, his velocity dropped, his stuff was all over the place, and he's a guy who's constantly dealt with injuries as well. So the Phillies shipped him off to Texas. So here you've got your two top starting pitching prospects, these supposedly top 100 elite starting pitching prospects the last couple of years, who the Phillies dealt away because they weren't confident in their ability to stay healthy. They kept getting hurt. And now with Mick Abel in his first full season in the minors for the Phillies, we have shoulder tendonitis. Now, I don't want to raise alarm bells unnecessarily. It just makes me a little nervous. We'll see how he does this year. I'm certainly not writing him off. I'm certainly not saying the Phillies should just be ready to throw him in any deal that comes along this offseason that might help. But I don't think you can rule it out. I don't think you can rule out trading Mick Abel. I would certainly avoid it if I could. One of the guys not on the Baseball America list is Andrew Painter, last year's number one pick. And we'll see in just a few minutes that he does appear on the Baseball Prospectus list. But these pitching prospects, they, especially when they have these arm injuries, they make me a little bit nervous. But we'll talk to Jeff about Mick Abel and the injury stuff here coming up in just a couple of minutes. Bryson Stott, again, number 67. So Abel 51 on their list. Stott, number 67 on their list. They basically kind of have him as a steady as she goes, nothing flashy, but also kind of a high floor type guy. 55 hit tool, 50 power hit, tool, 55 running, 55 fielding, 55 arm. Stott basically blitzed through the Phillies system last year. Hit really well in Redding, which is not atypical of most Phillies offensive prospects because Redding, as we all know, is a launching pad. Played a handful of games with AAA Lehigh Valley, and then went over to the Arizona Fall League, again, where you've got the thin air in Arizona, and so the ball does tend to jump there as well. But he had a terrific Arizona Fall League. He has great plate discipline. So unlike Scott Kingery when he came up, Bryson Stott's plate discipline profile is a little bit more big league ready. It does seem like the power's coming. And it certainly looks like, as we've talked about on this podcast and other podcasts, that the Phillies want him to compete for the starting shortstop job in 2022. Some of the guys, so they do not have Andrew Painter on this list. They don't have any of the catchers on this list. Ethan Martin not on this list. So just two Phillies prospects in the Baseball America Top 100. Mick Abel, nowhere near close to being ready to play for the Phillies, pitch for the Phillies. Bryson Stott, really the only top prospect in this organization who figures to make a significant contribution to the Phillies here in 2022, which is, again, the crux of the problem with this franchise right now, is that they cannot supplement the big league talent with minor league guys. And so if the Phillies want to enter this season with fewer holes than they had at the end of last year, they're going to have to go over the luxury tax. And again, I don't see that happening unless they change the rules. And even then, it may not happen. Jim Salisbury did note a couple other folks of interest, and I thought I'd pass these along. We were talking about Sixto Sanchez just a minute ago. They have Sixto Sanchez at number 64. Amazingly, Sixto Sanchez still has prospect eligibility. He has not pitched enough big league innings to no longer be considered a prospect. So even after all these years, 3 years after the JT Realmuto trade, right? And in 2020, when he made his big league debut and pitched a playoff game for the Marlins, he's still considered a prospect. And now at number 64 on the prospect list, 13 spots behind Mick Abel. So the bloom off the rose a little bit on Sanchez simply because he can't stay healthy. The stuff is there. It's always been there. The control has always been there. The command has always been there. It's his ability to stay healthy. And that is the big concern about Sixto Sanchez for Miami. One of the other guys that Jim Salisbury mentions is a corner infielder named Curtis Meade, who was originally signed by the Phillies, but traded to Tampa Bay a couple seasons ago for Christopher Sanchez. He's 97 on the Rays on the top 100 prospect list. He's a good hitter. When the Phillies traded him away, he was nowhere near on any of their top 30, top 40 prospect lists. But he has, in the Rays organization, really been developed. And look, that's what the Rays do, right? If he was in the Phillies organization, my guess is he's not a top 100 prospect right now. But the Rays know what they're doing with young players, and they go out of their way to make sure that they have a cohesive system in place to get these guys trained up and make them big league ready. And that's what they've done with this Curtis Meade kid. Hopefully the Phillies get something out of Christopher Sanchez this year. He could be in this rotation. And depending on when Zach Eflin gets back, he could be in the starting rotation to start the season. At the very least, I think you'll see him in the bullpen, but I would rather see the Phillies, if he's not going to be in the big league rotation, put him in the AAA rotation. Let him get stretched out. Let him make regular starts. The Phillies have got to find some minor league starting pitching, and Christopher Sanchez has to be kept in that role. I don't care how bad the bullpen gets. They got to stop converting these minor league starters into relievers unless they just have no starting profile. And I think Christopher Sanchez has a chance to be a back end of the rotation big league starter, which is what the Phillies would need this year. And so we'll see if the Phillies are able to get anything out of him. But the left-hander acquired from Tampa Bay a couple of years ago for Curtis Meade, Christopher Sanchez, not a top 100 prospect. Curtis Meade has turned himself into one thanks to the Rays' outstanding development of young players. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to jump into the Baseball Prospectus Top 101 with lead prospect writer for Baseball Prospectus, Jeff Paternostro, and we'll talk about some other Phillies prospects as well. That's coming up next here on Hittin' Season. Well, while we're waiting for some real Major League Baseball news to come down, and it looks like we're going to get some conversations going between the Players Union and Major League Baseball coming up, it looks like, next week. But in the meantime, we're still trying to find some stuff to talk about. But this is a good part of the year to kind of talk about the Phil's prospects, because a number of the prospect lists have been coming out, and one of the best are Baseball Prospectuses. And I've got Jeff Paternostro, who is the lead prospect writer for Baseball Prospectus, with me on the podcast this week. Follow him on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. So try to ignore the fact that he's a Mets fan. He's good people, and we're going to get his thoughts on the top 101 prospect list that they put out and the Phillies that are on it, and a couple other Phils prospects as well, and get his thoughts on the international draft. Lots to get to here in the next few minutes. Hey, Jeff, thanks so much for coming on Hittin' Season. How are you, buddy?
Doing well. You know, we're just about at the end of prospect list season. Our one-on-one went up today. We got a few more team lists. I'm finalizing the futures guide in the next week or so. I think I still have to do org rankings for the website, and then I can sleep again.
Yeah, I imagine this is kind of a very lengthy time for you guys. And, you know, I think one of the things, too, is that it must have been easier this year than last year, because at least this year you had some players, you had some minor league games to actually look at and go off of. You didn't just have, you know, intra-squad matchups. So it was this year a little bit easier because you at least had some minor league games to look at, and you had some college and some high school games to look at, as opposed to whatever it was in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, in a weird way, 2020 was easy because it wasn't, I don't want to say it was easy. There wasn't much we could do.
Yeah. Yeah.
We basically had to team source what we could. Mm-hmm. There's obviously players that played in the majors. You know, prospects like Ian Anderson and Sixto Sanchez and Ke'Bryan Hayes, who all made fairly significant jumps on our list because we got to see them in the majors, and mm-hmm. we're trying to project major league production ultimately.
Sure.
But it was nice to get back to the park. I got back out fairly early. I think the first thing I actually watched was a Connecticut high school baseball game, Frank Mazzucato, who went seventh overall to the Royals this year. So it was nice to get back to the game. You know, live looks are the basis of our product. We have writers all over the country. They were all very excited to get back to the games. It was a little weird at first, I think.
Yeah.
But you get back into the rhythm of it pretty quickly. And I did, it was nice to go into the process this year. I could just like pull up my notes from seeing Hudson Valley in August and write some Yankees prospects. It simplified the process. I don't know if it was easier per se. There was going to be less of a, I think we all got a little bit of a grace period mm-hmm. last year because mm-hmm. It was so difficult to, and we wrote this in an essay for the annual that we also republished on the website. Like, there were obviously breakouts behind closed doors in 2020.
Sure.
It was just very difficult. Some of them we heard about, some of them we didn't. It was just always going to be very difficult to gauge, A, how real they were because they're not playing in games, mm-hmm. and B, how many of them there were.
Yeah. Well, and this is why it's a little bit easier this year to at least have some content to you know, some game film, some all that stuff. You guys are able to, you know, just see a lot more this offseason. And so, folks, make sure to go over to Baseball Prospectus, check out their top 101. And also, they released the Phillies' top 10 prospects last week, I believe it was. You have three Phillies on the Baseball Prospectus top 101. I don't think the number one will be of any surprise to anybody. You have Mick Abel at number 41 on this list. Obviously, you know, Abel is a power arm. He started off in low A Clearwater this year. He missed starting in mid-July. He was shut down for the rest of the season with shoulder tendinitis. But before that all happened, what did you guys see from Mick Abel this year in Clearwater?
So clear plus stuff, power stuff. He was probably the top prep arm in the 2020 draft, and that's what you saw, a still projectable teenage prep righty going through some growing pains, you know, working out the repertoire a little, you know, trying to deepen the repertoire, work on his fastball command. I wrote in the report, you're looking at a guy that could have a seven fastball, six slider, and two average pitches beyond that in the curve and the change. And that is with average or better command, that is a front of the rotation starter. Mm-hmm. Now he's a long way away from that. He did the shoulder issue seems fairly minor, probably precautionary, but it's a shoulder issue. And I think the knock-on effect there more than the fact that he had a shoulder injury is that we didn't ever get to see him fully stretched out. Mm-hmm. I noted this in his blurb as well. The Phillies were fairly conservative with him for a full season assignment as a prep pitcher. He was throwing 3-4 innings and an outing, but they were slowly starting to stretch him out. And there's a scenario where he doesn't get hurt and spends August and the first half of September really showing what he's capable of. And, you know, then maybe he's in with pitchers like, I don't know, Cade Cavalli, top 25 type names. Because he has that kind of talent, it's just we haven't seen it yet. You know, Cavalli is a college arm, so it's not a perfect comparison, but he blitzed three levels this year.
Yeah.
So you kind of want – and Abel was never going to do that. But you did maybe want to see a little bit more out of him than you got. And, again, I don't think the shoulder issue is necessarily a long-term concern beyond the fact that he's a pitcher and had a shoulder issue. And, you know, pitchers are high variance because of injury risk anyway. But it's just a little bit unclear. And if you look at where we ranked him post-draft, we ranked him 54 coming into the season. Essentially, this isn't exactly how it works. But if you just look at like basic attrition, players graduating and whatnot, you can basically say his stock's more or less held steady, which isn't – it's not bad, certainly. Yeah. It didn't go down, but you would have maybe liked to see a little bit more from him on the mound this year.
Yeah, and I know you're saying the shoulder injury isn't—it doesn't seem to be serious. Although, again, you know, we are Phillies fans, and so we've been through Spencer Howard. You know, we went through Sixto Sanchez when he was a prospect, and he always seemed to be hurt. And we haven't seen a young Phillies pitching prospect make it through a full season healthy. Really in quite some time, and I'm talking like the upper echelon guys, when Sixto Sanchez was the number one guy, it seemed like every year he had some kind of injury. When Spencer Howard was here, same thing, and they never got Spencer Howard stretched out either because 2020 was so weird, and then he had an arm injury, and so 2021 they were only going to throw him three or four innings at a time. So I know Mick Abel is still years away, a couple years away from being a Philadelphia Philly, so there's time, and there's no need to rush him at this point, but it does cause Phillies fans like myself to just be a little bit nervous based on how the last two top pitching prospects in this organization, how their minor league careers progressed. So,
and there's certainly a larger conversation to be had about Phillies pitching development over the last half decade, really the last decade as well. And it's turned over enough at this point that I don't want to. I was looking at the 2016 Phillies list, which was one of the first lists I wrote for BP, and you've got that was my reaction as well. You got like guys like Jake Thompson and Franklin Colome and Adonis Medina, who's still actually technically
still
eligible
around.
For this
yeah.
list.
He's still around.
He was in the GCL that year. At a certain point, you look at it, and in the intermediate years, that was sort of towards the they were still sort of in the rebuild phase, but it's towards the beginning, and there was a period in between 2016 and the present where they had a lot of really interesting arms. And you look now, you know, Nola was a top 10 college pick that's hit like his 70th percentile outcome, which is nice, but you know, he was a good pitcher coming out of college. You probably would have thought he would be a safe number three starter. He's been more like a number two with some variance year to year within that. Mm-hmm. The only other pitching prospect that's really hit for them is Ranger Suarez, and he took a very circuitous way to get there. And I'm still not sure what he is in the medium term either. But they've had a lot of really good pitching prospects come through. And look, pitching prospects will break your heart, but at a certain point, you've maybe got to take a deeper look at what your player development system, how you're developing your pitchers, and if there's some sort of like systemic issue that's going on within the Phillies organization at this point. And again, they've had a fair bit of turnover there recently and even over the last half decade. So
yeah,
I don't know if that's necessarily predictive going forward. But yeah, if I was a Phillies fan, I would be a little nervous about it.
Yeah, I haven't even really been able to produce any bullpen arms of any reliability from some of their, so it's not even a matter of getting starters stretched out. They haven't even been able to, you know, Connor Brogdon may be one of the few guys that has been able to. And
what's up with Sir Anthony Dominguez?
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, he pitched last year. He came back and pitched a little bit. His velocity wasn't where it used to be. I think the Phillies seem to be hoping that he's going to be a part of the big league bullpen this year, and I don't know if they're going into this season thinking he's going to be a seventh or eighth inning guy and planning on that as that's the plan, then
right.
They get whatever they do, you know, they deserve whatever they get, because there's just no way you can plan for that being a real contingency. If it happens, great. And it could, but yeah, I have no idea what's going on with Sir Anthony Dominguez. I imagine we'll see a little bit, you know, if and when spring training rolls around. So, I did want to talk to you about the number two guy on your list, Andrew Painter, at number 82 in the top 101. And of course, Andrew Painter, you know, he's a baby. You know, he was just taken 13th overall in the 2021 draft. So in last year's draft, he didn't pitch very much in the Florida Coast League. So, what were you going off of? What were you basing kind of what you've seen from Andrew Painter? It was mostly like his high school stuff and kind of where he ranks as a prep arm as well?
Yep, certainly. Pre-draft reports, our draft writer, Keenan Lamb, who's now with the Cardinals, saw him a fair bit, both in the showcase circuit, and I believe he saw him during the high school season this year as well. So we have recent looks on him. We have got reports that he was touching 100 instructs, which is a little bit of a tick up from where he was as an amateur. You said he's a baby. He is a baby. He's a big baby. He is 6'8".
yes.
There's still a very projectable frame there. And it's, you know, very similar to the McAbel pick in 2020. And I believe Keenan made that comp even before the Phillies took him on his pre-draft big board. You're getting a guy that, you know, a little more fastball, probably a little more fastball to come as well. The breaking ball is not quite as good as Abel's, but he's also a year behind on the development curve with the secondary stuff. So it's a little bit more of a live arm, and he does some weird stuff too. He does like the Johnny Cueto mess with the hitters.
Oh, with the fancy
timing,
turn with
mechanic.
His rotation. Yeah.
I think it's more like the leg, the particular the leg kick than the really kind of out there stuff. But I don't know why you would do that if you can throw 100 as a high school kid in Florida, but yeah, more power to you. And Keenan noted to me how he was throwing like six different pitches in one start too. So he's a bit of a tinkerer, which, I mean, maybe you're bored if you're 6'8" and can throw 100 in high school baseball. But he's going to be a little bit more of a project. There's certainly an outcome where he comes out next year and looks like a top 50 prospect like Abel did this year. But it's a little, you know, the system's down from where it is. It's not a bad system. It's a little bit top heavy. It's not as deep as you'd like. But there is certainly risk in having your top two prospects be recent right-handed prep draftees. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah, they're not going to be in Philadelphia anytime soon, barring some unforeseen meteoric rise from either of these two guys, and that's just fine. One guy who very well could see the big league field, I think it would be a disappointment and a shock if he doesn't see time in Philadelphia this year, is Bryson Stott, who you also have in your top 101 at 93. He had a terrific Arizona Fall League, had an OPS of 934 there. Across three levels in the minors this year, had an OPS of 876. Spent most of the season in Redding after starting at Jersey Shore in high A ball, but did get 10 games at AAA Lehigh Valley. And it seems, Jeff, that Dave Dombrowski is at the very least, I think, hoping that Bryson Stott's going to make things interesting for them in spring training as far as the shortstop position is concerned, because nobody believes that Didi Gregorius is going to find the all-star Didi Gregorius once again. And so it certainly doesn't seem like they're in the Carlos Correa market or the Trevor Story market either. So your thoughts on Bryson Stott, and what is his upside? You know, what are we looking at from him in terms of a young shortstop?
So I say this as nicely as I can. Bryson Stott's kind of boring. And it's not a bad thing per se.
I don't think it's a bad thing.
You want this kind of surety if your top two prospects are high variance prep arms. We've got a lot of Bryson Stott looks over the year. You know, I saw him post draft season. Jarrett Seidler is based out of the Jersey Shore area. I saw him there. And look, there's not a weakness in his game. He does everything pretty well. It's a nice swing. It's a good approach. He can play shortstop. I don't really think that's ideal. Like, it's a better fit for second base, but he can play shortstop. He can also be a kind of guy that plays a little shortstop, plays a little second, could probably play corner outfield for you. Arm might be stretched at third, but sure, why not? Mm-hmm. So if you want to use him as more of a, you know, like a Chris Taylor type, you could do that. I don't exactly know what the upside and the bad is. Because there are some things to like here, certainly. I know he had a very good approach. He's got good bat-to-ball skills. He's got above-average raw power, although it doesn't really get into games consistently. You know, outside of the launching pads in Arizona and Redding, which is also its own launching pad. Although closer to a little bit less dry air, certainly.
Yeah.
But you look at the skill set, and it's like, all right, he hits 270, 280. Hits 15 to 20 home runs, plays an okay shortstop, probably a better fit for second base. That's a really nice player. You know, sign me up. Put that guy on my 25-man roster. He can even start for me pretty much every day.
He's like a three. It sounds like a 2-3 win guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we ranked him as we had an OFP 55, which would be like a 3+ win player, basically, for us. Very nice player. I should probably make, you know, very good chance to make the Phillies out of camp. They're going to be 24 this year. Good chance to make the Phillies camp. Actually, already 24, 18, 24 in the offseason. I do wonder. You said they're not going to be in on Carlos Correa and Trevor Story. And Bryson Stott, and again, I like Bryson Stott. We ranked him in the top 101. Should not be stopping you from doing that. Because first of all, play him. Yeah. You can play him in different positions, right?
Right.
He is a number 6th hitter on a very good team. And that's fine. You need that guy. I just do wonder sort of how committed they are to really putting the 2022 Phillies in a spot to try to win this division. And that's not saying anything bad about Bryson Stott if he's your starting shortstop, but it may be a little bit of a failure of imagination.
Well, that would be far out of the character of the Philadelphia Phillies to have a failure of imagination, Jeff. I can't believe you'd even suggest that something like that could be possible. They are, if not imaginative at all times. No, I agree 100% with you. The existence of Bryson Stott should not prevent them from going out and getting Carlos Correa and Trevor Story. And I think it's not. I think the thing that prevents them from doing it is the money. Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see what they do once this lockout ends. So I did want to talk about a couple other guys not on your list. Matt Vierling is a guy who is getting a lot of attention this offseason. I was intrigued by him. Many Phillies fans were intrigued by him. Seemed to hit everything hard. Seemed to hit a lot of it on the ground, which was reminiscent of the Michael Franco days. But a guy who just routinely hit a lot of balls hard. He's number 9 on your list of Phillies prospects, your Phillies top 10 that you put out last week. And right now, they're going to go out and get a left fielder. They're probably going to go get a center fielder as well. So Matt Vierling probably is not an everyday starter for this team. But based on what you saw at the big league level and what you saw from him in the minors this year, what do you think of Matt Vierling?
Look, again, this is a very nice player to have in your 25-man roster. He's got some positional flexibility. He can play center in a pinch. I would not roll him out there regularly. I mean, you noted sort of the two major things to look at here, right? He hits the ball very hard. He does not consistently elevate the ball. And that's, you kind of need both in modern baseball, unless you do a bunch of other things well, which, again, he has not really consistently done. He's not a particularly good defender. He's not a speed demon. It's not a great hit tool outside of the fact that he hits the ball really hard. It's fine. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Like, he makes a good amount of contact, but I know he hit 320. I know he hit a lot in Reading. He didn't hit a ton in AAA. You know, on balance, you're looking at something like probably average-ish major league hitter. And plenty of guys, and this applies to Stott too, I think I got a little sidetracked when I was talking about him. You look at this general skill set, these are guys that have mid-20s power breakouts with swing tweaks. Type of players that do. That does not mean that Bryson Stott will have it. That does not mean that Matt Vierling will have it. But that's what you're kind of dreaming on here a little bit, right? If he's hitting the ball 100 plus miles an hour and you just tweak that launch angle a little bit, but that can have unforeseen consequences as well. I think he's a good fourth outfielder. It's basically what we wrote in the report. Again, not ideal that guy is the ninth best prospect in your system. That probably means you have a below average system. We think the Phillies have a below average system at this point. Mm-hmm. But again, a perfectly nice player, should be on the roster. If he has to start for 6 weeks because someone gets hurt,
no, that'll work.
That works. That works. Yeah. You don't want to go in. Yeah, you want to go out and sign a center fielder. You want to go out and sign a left fielder so you don't have to plan on Matt Vierling playing for you every day.
Yeah, because right now he's on the depth chart playing two positions, which I find
sustainable. Always a good sign.
Yeah. I want to ask you about a couple other guys real quick. Logan Ohapi was another guy in the Arizona Fall League who we heard a lot about, hit the ball a ton. And the Phillies have some catching depth in the minors. And if they do swing a trade here this offseason, it's largely assumed one of their catchers is probably going to get moved in a trade. And Logan Ohapi seems to have more of the offensive upside. Real quick, what did you see from him in the Arizona Fall League? Again, understanding Arizona is kind of a launching pad out there, but from his time in the minors this year as well.
No, I mean, he played basically to the scouting report in the AFL. We saw him in Jersey Shore. We had Trevor Andreessen, our West Coast guy, out in the AFL as well, and I believe filed on him at the site if you want to dig in a little more on his report. But in a way, he's kind of a very 90s kind of catching prospect, right? Hits for a fair amount of power, good arm, controls the running game. We've learned a lot about framing in the last 20 years since then, and he's not... He's a little stiff back there. That is a teachable skill, which is a nice thing.
And the Phillies have been able to do that.
Yes, I remember when I saw him in playing for Williamsport in the Penn League. They had the jugs machine out and were working on a bunch of drills with the catchers before the game. They didn't take BP instead, and were doing that, which was very annoying to me as a prospect writer. But I did get to see Logan Ohapi work on his framing skills at Dodd Stadium in Norwich. So there was that. But yeah, that is certainly a teachable skill. It might not even be a necessary skill. The ABS is coming to the AAA West, the old PCL, next year. So they are moving apace with that. So if you have a guy that can control the running game and hit for power, although there's certainly some hit tool questions there too, and maybe some swing and miss at higher levels. But that was sort of more of a traditional, what I would call a 1B catcher, better than a true backup. And you don't really need a 1B catcher with JT Realmuto around for the foreseeable future. But, you know, on one level, that's good because, you know, you can get Realmuto if there's a universal DH this year. If you want to rest, you know, play Realmuto at first base once a week to get his bat into the lineup and keep him maybe a little more healthy over the course of a season. You know, maybe you want a catcher that can start 70 games a year instead of 50 games a year. And that's kind of what you're looking at for Ohapi.
I did want to ask you about one other guy, and it's somebody we didn't discuss before we got started. So I'll give you a second to kind of pull up some numbers if you need to, or pull up a little bit of information. But you have him at number 4 in your list of Phillies top 10, and this is the highest I've seen Griff McGarry after Mick Abel, Andrew Painter, and Bryson Stott. McGarry, of course, taken in the 5th round by the Phillies in this past draft. Again, he didn't play a whole lot. He went to Clearwater and got was in 5 games there as a pitcher. Pitched 11 innings. So again, stats don't really matter when that's all you've got under your belt. But I was intrigued by his name being so high on your list. What is it about Griff McGarry you guys like?
So that's a Jarrett Seidler special. He saw him in Jersey Shore, and like, look, you can. One of the nice things this year is you can go to Griff McGarry's Baseball Savant page, go to his game logs, and just pull him up. You can backdoor his TrackMan stats from Clearwater. Mm-hmm. And the stuff is certainly comparable to Andrew Painter and Mick Abel. And the stuff's never really been a question there. The reason he was drafted in the 5th round and people are surprised he's that high on the list is because he never walked fewer than 8 per 9 at the University of Virginia.
Yeah. And that's bad.
It's not good. No, that's a lot of walks. That's almost a walk an inning. So the command is certainly an issue, but it was better in the pros. It wasn't great, but it was better in the pros. And I mean, there's an argument that this is not uncommon, I will say, for University of Virginia pitchers to get better in the pros. Mm-hmm. So a nice pit of Jared was talking to an amateur scout that saw him and said that he was like throwing balls to the backstop every start he saw for Virginia. So there is a limit to how teachable command is, but when it's that bad, like there might be some easy fixes.
Yeah,
and there's certainly still relief risk here. You know, even if he's walking 4 or 5 per 9, that's not ideal for a starter. That would be a huge long term gain for his control and command profile. Mm-hmm. But the stuff is really good, and you look down at the guys past him. I'm a big Johan Rojas guy, mm-hmm. for sure. I love Johan Rojas. He did not hit enough in Clearwater, frankly. I know there were injuries there. I know they had COVID issues down there all year. He was certainly better for in his late season promotion for Jersey Shore. I suspect, because I know I'll be doing this list next year, if he hits it all next year, I'm going to get him in the 101. I thought he'd get there this year. It just didn't quite come together for him. I think Rojas is a better prospect than Griff McGarry, but Jared saw both of them for a week in Jersey Shore and disagreed with me. So I will defer to the live looks there. And look, McGarry has upside, and he has a very good relief fallback too, is the other thing. Mm-hmm. If the command doesn't quite get there, he can be a very good late inning reliever. Again, not ideal for the 4th best prospect in your system. And I do think it's very fluid after the top 3 to an extent. Like, I don't specifically put tiers here. Funnily enough, my pref list 3 through 10 would be different than Jarrett's, would be different than Keenan's, who saw Clearwater a fair bit. You know, it's kind of like a little bit of push and pull. Like, I would have Rojas 4. I don't know if Jarrett would have Rojas in the top 10. Wow. So, you know, I would have Ethan Wilson lower personally. I know Jarrett would have Luis Garcia higher personally. I would probably have Simon Muziati higher personally. So it all comes out. We're all talking about like sort of like somewhere between 50, you know, somewhere between average regulars and maybe a little bit above average regulars.
Right. And it's all kind of, just kind of a witch's brew there because they're all of a similar, so it's just kind of preference
and
at that
point. And they're all fairly far away from, outside of Veerling, they're all fairly far away from the majors at this point. There's not a lot of upper minors talent here, and those that they're, you know, Francisco Morales took a big step back backwards this season with his command. You know, they traded for Hans Kraus, who's fine. I was never super in on him as a Rangers prospect. He doesn't really have the high end velocity that he showed coming out of the draft and as a, you know, the beginning of his pro career. But has developed a pretty good changeup, weirdly enough. So, you know, he's on that weird sort of like somewhere between starter and reliever tier.
Yeah, I imagine we'll see him in Philadelphia a little bit this year.
Yeah, I would certainly think so. You know, it does become a little bit of a struggle. It's a much shallower system now, which is a problem because they certainly still need they need to find a way to supplement the major league team. There's only so many free agents you can sign. There's only so many holes you can fill with that. You'd like to see like more pitchers, especially. I think closer to the majors at this point.
Yeah, we've traded away any of the ones that looked like they were getting close because it just wasn't happening. So, of course, we'll all be wringing our hands if Spencer Howard lights it up for Texas this year, but we'll see how that plays out. I did want to run one other thing by you before you leave. The Phillies signed a 17-year-old kid out of Venezuela for a little over $2 million this week, William Bregoya Jr. Obviously, we don't know anything about this kid. We don't know anything about these international signings. And I was talking on the last edition of Hit and Season with Justin and Liz about kind of the unsightliness, the unseemliness of some of the deals that are reached with these kids who are in some cases 16, maybe even younger than that. In this case, this kid's 17 years old. And I know you have done a lot on the international draft and kind of what it, you know, some of the stuff that's not so great about this and the whole process that goes on here. Can you just talk a little bit about your thoughts on the international signing process?
Yeah, but there has to be a better way is what it ultimately comes down to. And you know, this was in the news today. There was an article on The Athletic from Maria Torres and Ken Rosenthal really diving into it. And I think for a mainstream baseball article on the subject, it was very, very good because it very plainly laid out what is happening in a reportable format. And you don't see that very often. You see it alluded to. I mean, you can go out today if you wanted and figure out who's, you know, the top guys for 2024, where they're signing and for how much. And those kids are like 14 right now. And they probably signed before that. It just is when it generally starts to leak.
Yeah.
And I don't have a good fix for this. It's not an international draft. What an international draft will do will eliminate some of the unseemliness of the reporting around it. It will clean that up. You won't be hearing about the, you know, you'll get the American amateur draft terms. You'll get the Phillies have heat on this player. They have a lot of guys out to see him at the showcase in wherever. So you'll get that instead of the Phillies are expected to sign X player for X millions of dollars on for this signing class. So you won't get that. And that looks bad. It's not a good look for Major League Baseball, but they can fix that whenever they want. They know, like, they can read the same reports on this stuff. They can call up the team and say, no, stop doing this. They can stop it whenever. They can enforce their own rules on when these teams and these players can agree to deals. But they don't really want to do it. You know, BA wrote about this a few years ago, and I think the impression for the trainer side in the Dominican and elsewhere was that they want to make this as messy as possible to get buy-in for the idea of an international draft as being the only way to clean it up. And it's not. Look, and these kids signing at 16 is not ideal. These kids dropping out at 12 to train to maybe sign at 16 and certainly earlier than that, even if you start enforcing the rules, is not ideal. But they will not enforce their own rules on the books unless it's very egregious, unless it's kickbacks to front office members, unless it's very clear bundling, unless it's very clear bundling plus what the Braves were doing. And the interesting thing to me is one of the major things the Braves got hit for was funneling money to Robert Poisson, who ended up signing with the A's after he was made a free agent, although he was still technically, he was always a free agent because he wasn't eligible to sign yet, early, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And look, they should not be signing these kids at 13. But when they agree to these deals, it works primarily one way. The team can agree to the deal. If the player gets hurt or if they want to end up wanting to spend their money elsewhere, they can drop. They can either renegotiate the bonus down or they can just say they're not going to sign the kid. Conversely, if they agree to a, let's say, $150,000 deal with a 14-year-old and 18 months later, he's grown 4 inches and added 30 pounds and 2 grades of power, he can't go shop that deal. I mean, he can, but it's very, very rare to see a team come in for another team's player.
Mm-hmm.
Because, A, they don't really get to see them once these agreements happen. They end up in their academy or they just hide them, for lack of a better term. So a lot of teams don't have information on the players that have gotten better other than sort of industry scuttlebutt or stuff like that. And they don't want other teams doing it to their guys.
Right.
So you can call that what it is, but it doesn't cut both ways. So my point is, like, if they thought Robert Poisson was worth that at 13, it feels awful to say it, but if you think he's a good age, pay him the money then. Have some. There's no skin in the game, right?
Right.
Again, all of this is very, very messy. The suggestion I've made in the past is something maybe akin to a European soccer academy kind of style, where you have very clear rules for training and education and nutrition and how often they can play and stuff like that. And there's a process where you have to offer them a professional contract by a certain date, or other teams come in and there's like regular games and stuff where other teams can scout them too. And maybe there's there's often some sort of like contractual limit. Again, I don't think that's a perfect solution. There's probably significant carry-on effects that I haven't considered in that model. I think it's better, but I don't have enough. This is not my area of expertise for a number of reasons, because I find it particularly distasteful. But I do know that what they have now simply does not work. And the only thing an international draft will solve is probably save teams money. And they will have less. People like me will not be on Twitter yelling about the way we talk about 14-year-olds that have already agreed to contracts and anything but actual force.
Right. Well, it is. It's like you use the term. I think I've heard the term used Wild West of baseball, and it's. We forget the Wild West was pretty darn awful in a lot of ways.
And I mean, I would definitely encourage everyone to go and read the article at The Athletic. It spells out, it spells out exactly the process that as it happens, really. Juan Soto talks about his own experiences fairly candidly, and he's a rare one. He really didn't start focusing on baseball until 15 and still got a 7-figure deal. His younger brother's been in the news recently, Elian Soto, he posted a photo on Instagram in Mets gear, but now is signing with the Nats. And I mentioned that teams don't generally approach other teams' players. It was never clear to me if Soto had actually agreed to the Mets. He's a 2023 J2. But it did, the Mets did sign a player a few days ago for this period that was previously linked to the Nats. So again, you can read into that what you want. but it's all you shouldn't, I don't enjoy talking about this as probably clear. I don't think a draft solves a lot of the fundamental issues. And we've seen sort of the, what happened when Puerto Rico got added to the draft. It eliminated a lot of sort of the baseball infrastructure there. I don't know if that'll happen in the Dominican or not. You know, the teams, a lot of these teams already have academies up and running, so I don't know. At that point, you might as well just, like, there's probably still, the infrastructure's already been built, so that you might as well keep it. I don't think the actual probably day-to-day costs are that high relative to a Major League Baseball team's overall budget, but I think there could be, anytime Major League Baseball teams can outsource player development or this kind of stuff to other places in their own budget lines, they'll do it, so I wouldn't bet against it either.
Well, we'll see what the new CBA has to say about the international signing, but it obviously is something that it's something that needs to be fixed. But what that fix is, as you're talking about, we don't really know. But this is a pipeline right now for major league teams. This is how a lot of young stars are brought to the big leagues eventually. So we'll see how that all plays out, and we'll see how things shake out with the international signings and with these top prospects that are going to be getting back into action here in the next couple of months. Folks, make sure you go over to Baseball Prospectus and check out everything Jeff's doing over there. Check out their top 101. Check out their top 10 Phillies lists. All of the stuff they've got going on is over on their website, Baseball Prospectus. And don't forget to follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. Jeff, thanks for coming back on Hitting Season, man. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
And now it's time for your stat of the week. This from our own Leo Morgenstern at The Good Fight. The Phillies have three prospects, as you just heard a second ago, on the BP Top 101. If you look at some other teams in the division, unfortunately, the Atlanta Braves, who have won three straight division titles and are the defending world champions, how many prospects do they have in the BP Top 101? They have five. And the Miami Marlins, who finished below the Phillies in 2021 but are a team on the rise, have six prospects. Now, like the Phillies, the New York Mets also have just three prospects. However, they have the number 10 prospect in baseball, catcher Francisco Alvarez, and then they also have the number 13 prospect in baseball, a third baseman by the name of Brett Beatty. So, yes, the same number of prospects in the top 101, but the Mets have two of the top 13, including a top 10 in Francisco Alvarez, and then, again, number 13 in Brett Beatty. And then you only have to go down a little bit further on the list to number 51 to find their third prospect on the list, a shortstop named Ronnie Mauricio. So, yes, they don't have more prospects in the list than the Phillies do, but the prospects they do have on there are certainly much higher up. In addition, the Washington Nationals also have three prospects on this list, and again, not more than the Phillies, but they have prospects who are higher up on the list than anything the Phillies have. Washington's top prospect is right-handed pitcher Cade Cavalli. He comes in at number 19 on the Baseball Prospectus list. You go down a little bit further and you have catcher Keibert Ruiz, who we saw a little bit at the big league level last year. He's number 39 on the Baseball Prospectus top 101. And then you scroll down just a little bit further on their list, not too far down, and you've got shortstop Brady House at number 66 on the BP top 101. So, the Phillies lagging behind the rest of the division in high-end prospects, which really shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks once again to Jeff Paternostro for coming on the podcast. Don't forget to check out the Hittin' Season Patreon. Go over to patreon.com/hittin'season to get all the latest bonus content there. And again, don't forget to check out the Good Fight podcast feed, where we've got all kinds of great content for you, even during this baseball drought. Go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcasts, to check it all out, and check out thegoodfight.com every day. I've got an interesting article up there looking at expectations. What are reasonable expectations for the Phillies rotation in 2022? And I'll talk about that with Justin and Liz coming up this weekend on the podcast as well. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.